Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This podcast is free, and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks!
Seattle music was an unstoppable force in the early 90s. Its influence colored every aspect of pop culture, from television and film to literature and fashion. Albums by Seattle bands sold in the millions. A handful of marquee names boosted the visibility of dozens of smaller acts. Their songs were on permanent radio rotation, their videos played night and day on MTV, and they headlined festivals around the world. Grunge was like a freight train carrying the city's newly minted celebrity status to the farthest corners of the earth. And just as the train reached top speed, it went off the rails.
Kurt Cobain, the lead singer of the enormously popular rock band Nirvana, is dead at the age of 27.
Kurt Cobain's body was found inside a garage apartment adjacent to his Seattle home. He was among the most powerful voices of his generation.
Everything changed on April 8th, 1994. Kurt Cobain's suicide shocked the world. Less than a year earlier, Nirvana had released their third album. In Utero debuted at number one on the Billboard 200, solidifying Nirvana's place atop the rock and roll pantheon. They were the biggest band on the planet. Kurt had long been troubled by addiction, and he had a hard time handling stardom and the intense public scrutiny that came with it. His sudden death was a punch to the gut, and it hit Seattle particularly hard. 2 days later, more than 10,000 fans came together for a spontaneous gathering at Seattle Center.
Fans brought flowers, notes, even candles. And like Erica Miller, they brought their grief.
His music meant so much. It touched so many people's hearts that it's really difficult.
When I heard the news, it felt like I lost one of my best friends. Really did. Really sucked.
I just think that it's a loss. I like Kurt Cobain a lot, and I listen to Nirvana a lot. And there's no more Nirvana, so he's gone.
The vigil took place right beside the site of Nirvana's last local concert. The band brought the In Utero tour to Seattle Center Arena for two shows just 3 months earlier, the biggest venue Nirvana had ever played in the city. Big enough that it could afford the expensive security and insurance required to allow under 18-year-olds to see the band alongside anyone over 18, which was a rare opportunity. The small nightclubs where Nirvana played most of their shows were off limits to young fans thanks to Seattle's teen dance ordinance. The law had been on the books since 1985. Nirvana's impact was immense, and Cobain's passing cast a dark shadow over the city. Everyone felt it. Combined with the oppressive atmosphere created by the TDO, the gravity Seattle once exerted was dissipating. The city had failed young artists and fans alike. Instead, all ages shows went into the suburbs outside the city, giving rise to a new crop of Northwest bands. But the TDO didn't completely kill the all-ages scene in Seattle. Music lovers got creative. One solution was illicit shows in basements and backyards, off the radar of local authorities. Another was to exploit exceptions buried within the language of the TDO. Turned out nonprofit organizations and religious institutions were exempt from the law, which led to a volunteer-run space blossoming in the heart of the city, galvanizing the local music community when it was at its most distraught and diminished. And another all-ages venue in the sanctuary of a Christian church, opened by a religious group hoping to draw young music fans into its flock. This one did not end well. These unlikely locales were crucial anchors to the scene. They were also, for their own reasons, deeply fraught. It illustrates one of the lasting lessons of the TDO era. When all other options are stripped away, young people will make the music happen however they can, even if it puts them in danger. From KUOW in Seattle, I'm Jonathan Zwickel, and this is Let the Kids Dance.
Hey there, I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of a podcast called Bay Curious that answers listener questions about the Bay Area.
How did all of this eucalyptus get to the Bay Area?
How long does it take for water to get from Hetch Hetchy to San Francisco?
Want to know the answers? Subscribe to the Bay Curious podcast or visit baycurious.org.
Recognize that voice? That's Dave Grohl, live on stage. A year after Kurt Cobain's death, the former Nirvana drummer started his own band. Their public debut was at Seattle's one and only all-ages concert venue.
To my knowledge, we did the first paid show of the Foo Fighters.
Meg Wachin started producing events at the Velvet Elvis in early 1993, including this inaugural Foo Fighter show on March 4th, 1995, which was supposed to be a secret.
We tried to keep it on the down low. We actually didn't put them on the flyer. We were trying to just promote the show with the other bands that the Foo Fighters had chosen to play.
Yeah, well, word got out. A line of fans wound around the block. Inside, more than 200 of them packed the venue beyond capacity. Meg had to turn away hundreds of people.
It was a wonderful show. It was very generous of the band to play such a cozy, small venue. Kids' faces, just watching everyone surrounding the band.
Generous because Foo Fighters were intent on entering the world with an intimate, all-ages performance. It was in their DNA. Two of the original members came from the band Sunny Day Real Estate. They got their start playing to teens at the old firehouse in Redmond. Foo Fighters' first show jitters were obvious. They looked and sounded super raw, a far cry from the arena-ready polish of their first album, which was only months from release. But everyone in the room was totally engaged. No bar or booze to distract them. Fans stood on the stage, surrounding the band. Some even jammed right up in front of them.
People were just enthralled being so close. It was a really cool thing that they did. It was like a real honor to host them.
Meg arrived in Seattle in 1992 from Providence, Rhode Island. Her older sister had moved out earlier. Meg knew Seattle's Sub Pop records from her college radio station. In Providence, she went to all-ages shows featuring weird upstart bands. Given all the incredible music Seattle had spawned in the last few years, surely it would offer a killer music community too. But
it was bifurcated. It was definitely sort of split between 21 plus, which it just seemed silly. I mean, if you're in a band, how do you get bigger and better? It just didn't seem like there was a space for that or a way for that to happen.
The scrappy scene Meg was searching for had been driven underground by the Teen Dance Ordinance. The TDO aimed to protect people under 18 from exposure to illegal drugs and unscrupulous adults, but it ended up shutting down all-ages spaces and forcing most concerts into bars. Live music was everywhere in Seattle, but if you were under 21, it was virtually impossible to participate. The solution for young fans and smaller bands was clandestine shows at punk houses spread across the city.
You just throw a show, you know, take a couple bucks at the door for the band to have gas, that kind of thing. Like very just grassroots DIY.
We would do house shows all the time. My bands would play in basements of people's houses.
Jeff Bettger started his band 90 Pound Wuss in the Olympic Peninsula town of Port Angeles, and soon relocated to Seattle's University District. The neighborhood was home to some legendary band houses in the 80s and 90s, and Jeff's was one of them, Hiawatha House. Three bedrooms, big basement, punks everywhere.
You'd just get old mattresses and whatever and put it in your basement and have band practice.
Yeah.
And it would sound like woo, muffled like music being played if you were outside, but it was unlikely for people to care.
In the summer, when the weather was good, some of these places would host bands in their backyards. Soul House was famous for wild shows that happened on the backyard skate ramp.
There was so many people like jumping off of their amps, the guitar player's amps and everything. And it was complete and utter bonkers. Like the walls ended up having holes in them, the sheetrock and stuff, by the time it was done. It was just crazy show.
But otherwise mostly safe and like self-contained.
Yeah, even that was safe. Nobody got hurt.
The TDO made running a regulated all-ages venue almost impossible. So punk houses were an alternative means of keeping the music scene alive. They were a lawless version of the DIY spirit of the old firehouse, which was operating legally in Redmond.
That's what you do when you basically live in a very liberal artistic city that has antiquated laws that look like the movie Footloose. I mean, that's essentially, you just find your way to do shit. Like, yeah, that's essentially right. What we did.
You have to rebel.
Yeah, and if you're way into your own music, you're going to find a way to perform it for somebody somehow.
Because of their underground nature, punk houses didn't advertise their shows. They were cheap and open to anyone, but also exclusive. Either you knew someone who knew someone, or you lived in the neighborhood and followed the noise. But as fun as they were, bands also wanted to play formal venues with professional sound and lights, where they could bring more people in the door. So when Meg Waitgen heard from a friend in a San Francisco punk band who was looking for a place to play in Seattle, she mentioned a few legit venues that might book them.
They were like, oh, those places are 21 plus. We know about them, but we only play all ages. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, that's kind of a revelation. So I was like, oh, that's badass. You only play all ages. Okay, I'll find a place for you to play.
Meg called every event space she could find in the phone book. But when she explained that she wanted to host a concert, she got more or less the same response from everyone.
We don't do that anymore. You know, somebody left the place a mess or the police came or something like that. So it seemed like certainly Seattle's efforts to quash the whole thing had seeped into the ability to rent these places, you know?
Meg could only find interest from bars or punk houses. All of Seattle's unconventional art spaces, like the Bird and Gorilla Gardens, they were gone.
I think the Seattle scene at the time suffered. There just wasn't that gritty place to sort of birth cool things, you know? Unfortunately, you might have to flout some laws to do it. It was very much like, fuck the laws.
So Meg went renegade, which led her to put on all-ages performances herself at the Empire Rent-A-Car Garage downtown and in the auto mechanics bay underneath it.
I don't even know if the guys who we paid to use the space were the owners of the business that occupied it. I just know that they worked there and they were total shysters, and they like, it was just very nerve-wracking because there'd be like a pile of kids in the ramp. And, you know, it seemed like a smart thing to kind of encourage people not to hang out in the street so we wouldn't attract like cops and stuff. So we kind of had corralled people down the ramp, and then like one of these yahoos would try to like drive their car up the ramp, and it was nuts, you know? And meanwhile, we'd be trying to like get the next band to play.
That sounds like chaos.
Yeah, it was chaos.
I'm glad that everybody made it out okay.
It was a fucking nightmare. Like the shows were awesome, but the guys who rented us the space, they would drive in and out, revving their cars and almost hitting kids. It was just crazy.
The garage concert scenario demonstrated the same lesson that Keith Aspey discovered when cops shuttered his hip-hop dance parties, pushing him into dicier, unregulated venues. When safety measures such as the TDO don't accurately address the needs of the public, they end up endangering the people they're supposed to protect. Like so many would-be concert promoters before her, Meg was ready to admit defeat. Seattle was just too hostile to the kind of music community she dreamed of. Then Meg got a phone call from a friend who connected her to the exact kind of space she was looking for, an experimental theater in a historic building.
The Velvet Elvis was an existing, you might call it an off-Broadway theater or like a cool alternative theater down in Pioneer Square. And it had been set up by this great group of creative folks.
Creative folks who desperately needed money. Meg says the theater was $20,000 in debt, most of which was accumulating interest on board members' credit cards. So they offered the use of the theater during dark weeknights and during the day on weekends.
They rented it as like an empty black box. They got risers, they got seats. I'm not sure if there was a stage there, but they found used curtains and they made the space look really cool. They hung these funky old thrifted lamps from the ceiling, and that was the lighting, you know, when the lights would come up.
In the entrance hallway to the theater hung the namesake portrait, Elvis Presley in Shakespearean garb, holding a human skull in the mode of Hamlet's Alas, Poor Yorick monologue, painted on black velvet. Meg loved the off-Broadway vibe of the theater, but what really turned her on about the Velvet Elvis was its nonprofit status.
If you were a nonprofit, you were exempt from the teen dance ordinance, and the Velvet Elvis was a nonprofit. Falling under their nonprofit umbrella allowed us to do events without the threat from the teen dance ordinance shutting down shows. We were hassled in other ways, but at least the teen dance ordinance we were exempt from.
It was the green light she'd been waiting for.
My chief concern was definitely to do my best to provide a safe space for kids, because growing up can be so alienating, especially if you're questioning anything from gender to sexuality to your existence on the planet. So to have a space where you can go and be yourself, that was something that was really important to me to promote and preserve. And I certainly got a fair amount of shit from it.
The venue split all door proceeds with the bands 50-50. Profits would go right back into the theater. To keep costs low, concert staff was made up of volunteers, mostly teens and college students. A tenuous business model, to be sure. Meg's first booking was The Grifters, a band from Memphis on Sub Pop. They opened the Velvet Elvis on a Wednesday night in October 1993.
I just remember it being very exciting that things were happening in what felt like a sort of safe space, that the show felt real. We're exempted from this dumb teen dance ordinance thing. There's a roof over our heads. There's no one driving a car through a pile of kids. You know, they were not super well attended, those early shows.
Running an all-ages venue in the TDO era was risky, legally and financially. But it was working. Attendance picked up. The shows were excellent. But sure enough, once more people caught on, so did the authorities.
The fire department would come, the liquor board would come, the police would come. Like, they tried every which way, even though we were exempt from, you know, the teen dance ordinance that it didn't matter. They still tried to shut the shows down.
Meg once encountered a pair of cops outside the venue walking the Pioneer Square beat. They told her the music was too loud. She had to turn it down or they were going to pull the plug.
They were like, yeah, there's noise ordinances, you know. And I was like, yeah, I know. I'm totally aware. Like, we do happen to be between the level of this and this decibels. And it is after 8 a.m. in the morning, actually. So I have a noise meter inside. Do you want me to go get it? I can show you. Which was total bullshit. and they just lost interest and just kind of walked off.
Why do you think that is?
I think adults might be afraid of what kids are capable of. But, you know, but to me, I just saw it as squashing creativity. It really did seem almost coordinated, just the number of, I'll use the word attacks, you know, that we had to sort of creatively and intelligently fend off.
She needed help. And I knew a friend of a friend and kind of got involved, and it transformed me. It really made a difference.
James Keblis was a student at the University of Washington in 1995 when he started volunteering at the Velvet Elvis. It was a formative time for him and for Seattle's shifting musical landscape.
We put on like Death Cab for Cutie shows and Modest Mouse shows when they were kids, you know, like their first shows. It was a real community place and everybody was doing it together and everybody was contributing to promote the shows and market the shows and clean up after the shows and everything. You just got a sense of being part of something really big. And that's really shaped me. From here on out, I'm going to do this.
We were able to keep the doors open because we had volunteers. We would try to buy lunch for the volunteers out of our 50% if that much money came in. If not, we would try to give as much as we could to the bands so they could get to their next place.
The acts were usually committed to the all-ages DIY ethos. Foo Fighters, Modest Mouse, Death Cab for Cutie, Slater Kinney, Bikini Kill, Jeff Buckley, they all love performing at the Velvet Elvis. In 1994, Green Day's Billy Joe Armstrong brought his solo act, Pinhead Gunpowder, to play to a packed house. Rocky Votolato is a veteran singer-songwriter in Seattle. As a teenager, he was voracious about live music, but his options were extremely limited.
So either it happened at the Velvet Elvis and you were able to see it, or you couldn't go.
Or I couldn't go. Yeah, and I was frustrated a lot of times by not being able to go to shows. And I think it made it harder for bands to come to Seattle because they didn't have as many places to play. I'm in
love with the world. Elliott Smith played the Velvet Elvis twice. The girl is still around the morning after. Perhaps because the Portland singer-songwriter's career was so brief and so incandescent, these shows left a deep mark. Meg, Rocky, and Sub Pop CEO Megan Jasper were all there.
You could hear a pin drop when he played. People were just enraptured.
We all sat on the floor, and he just had a chair in the middle, because literally it was only 15 people there, maybe 20. And it was just mind-blowing.
Songs were perfect. He was perfect. The space was fucking rad. It was everything to me. And seeing him play and do those songs live in Pioneer Square was one of the greatest music memories I have. To be that close to an artist, it is a more intimate experience. You're right there with them, your feet away from them. There's something just so magical about that. But as a young person in that room, to have that space to connect with other people and to be a part of it and to grow up with these folks that you do have shared values with, like, that's fucking cool.
In the pop music world, quiet, intimate performances are exceedingly rare. But I can tell you from experience that they happen at all ages venues. Young crowds generate a particular kind of reverential energy. Artists feel it, and they radiate it back. The Velvet Elvis hosted thousands of bands over its six-year run. During that time, it was Seattle's sole concert space dedicated to all-ages music. It registered no violence or serious incidents. But even successful nonprofits are difficult to maintain. At a time when the music scene was demonized by politicians and civic leaders, institutional support for a rock venue was poor. Meg's policy of splitting door profits with bands was equitable, but it was barely profitable.
We did not break even until the month before we closed, which felt really satisfying, but also really sad. But, you know, we charged only $5 ever, I think, until the last two shows, and it was hand-to-mouth.
June 26, 1999, was the Velvet Elvis' last show. The Melvins headlined.
I was crushed at not being able to continue to provide a space for people to go and for art to happen. But days after we closed this venue called The Paradox that was opening up, it was like an old theater on the Avenue District, and it was used as a church. I think it was by the Mars Hill sect, which, if you're not familiar with that, you might have to Google that, Jonathan, but some not great stories.
Coming up after the break, that venue inside a church saves all ages music, but the secrets it holds threaten the entire scene.
At Soundside, we bring you news and conversation rooted in the Pacific Northwest. Hi, I'm Libby Denkman. I think of my job hosting Soundside as, number one, asking tough questions of powerful people, the questions you, KUOW listeners, want answered. And two, bringing you a daily slice of the fascinating, confounding, and often goofy side of life in Washington State. Join me for Soundside at noon and 8 p.m. on KUOW or anytime on the Soundside podcast.
I didn't have to Google Mars Hill. The stories about Seattle's conservative Christian megachurch made national news. Meg describing them as not great states the case rather mildly. Mars Hill Church is part of another lesser-known chapter of the Seattle music story. See, back at the turn of the millennium, Seattle was the epicenter of Christian rock. Tooth & Nail, the richest and most prolific Christian rock record label in America, was based here, right across the street from the Velvet Elvis, in fact. At the same time Christian rock was having a moment in Seattle, bands were playing legal all-ages shows at Christian churches across the city. Because, along with nonprofits like the Velvet Elvis, religious institutions were also exempt from the teen dance ordinance.
I think local churches saw an opportunity there. They saw that there was this gap in youth outreach that they could fill.
Megan Sealing was a suburban Seattle teen in the late 90s. She loved live music, and church shows were one of the few ways to experience it. She says churches opened the doors of their social halls and basements with the promise to keep religion out of the picture.
They're not all Christian bands. It's not all Christian rock, and we won't preach or anything. Like, it's not about going to church. It's just we want you kids to have a place to go and see shows. There isn't any other place in the city.
Even if it was Christian rock, you might not have known it by listening. Jeff Becker's band 90 Pound Wuss, they were a Christian band.
I always grew up on the edge as far as like independent evangelical Christianity and punk rock.
And they were signed to Tooth & Nail.
The owner of Tooth & Nail Records was a genius to expose kids to this countercultural music. This sounds weird to anybody who's never listened to Christian music, but my band 90 Pound Wuss and other bands were literally like the first punk band some of these kids in Texas or Oklahoma or somewhere in the Bible Belt and South had ever heard in their life. He really got to use that faith as a marketing tool.
It was an interesting time for Seattle music. According to Jeff, Tooth & Nail's Christian bands were just as quintessential as their secular counterparts.
There was either like Sub Pop adjacent or like Tooth & Nail and Tooth & Nail adjacent kind of things happening in the city at the same time.
I'll come down tomorrow morning and meet you at our new location.
Some Christian singer-songwriters like Damian Jurado and Dave Bazan were fixtures of the all-ages scene. They released music on Tooth & Nail and on Sub Pop. The line between Christian and secular music was blurry. Both styles were featured at church shows, even ones that weren't billed as religious. But that didn't stop the more ambitious pastors from getting on stage between sets to preach.
Try to be like the cool pastor, the cool the cool guy being like, I know you're not here to hear this, but just so you know, God loves you even if you don't love him. And even if you're here listening to punk or metal or like whatever it was. And there would be some cases like kids would go outside, kids would turn their back to it. I think not having actual all ages venues, that was one of the downsides of it is like anybody could kind of start their own unofficial all-ages venue. And it could be people who had sort of like a predatory nature, like Mars Hill.
Mars Hill Church launched from Mark Driscoll's Seattle living room in the mid-90s. The ministry grew quickly over the years, finding bigger and bigger spaces to accommodate its surging congregation. It sold itself as the church for people who don't go to church, with the young, spiky-haired, guitar-playing Driscoll as the punk rock pastor. You can hear what they're going for in this 2003 promotional video.
From punk to grunge to indie rock, the Seattle sound is unmistakable. From the beginning, Mars Hill has incorporated Seattle's many musical styles into its worship.
Driscoll's cool Christian messaging found an audience, even in a city with a long-standing skepticism of organized religion.
Music, we believe, is something that was created by God. In fact, there's an Old Testament book that speaks about God as a musician and a songwriter. We believe that one of the reasons that people love music is because God is a creator. He has made us to be creative. And so for us, music is a very sacred thing.
The Paradox opened in the University District in 1999, right in time to fill the void left by the death of the Velvet Elvis. The fact that it was owned and operated by Mars Hill was more of a curiosity than a barrier to entry. They'd throw hardcore shows on Saturday night, then host worship services on Sunday morning in the exact same space.
I felt like, well, this is great. This is the Church of Immaculate Loophole. And the reason why it happened was because of the teen dance ordinance, because they already had the insurance for gathering as a religious nonprofit.
Jeff went to Mars Hill Church services in between tours with 90 Pound Wuss. Driscoll asked him to play bass in the church worship band, and Jeff brought his connections in the music scene to book bands at the Paradox. Christian or secular, it didn't matter much to Jeff. He was just glad to have a space to showcase the music he loved.
This church let me do all this shit there that I was already a part of and going to, and I was a part of the scene. Look, in hindsight, I think I was definitely like, how could you say it? They were seeking me out, and they definitely used me for my clout and ability, and they had other ideas that I wasn't aware of.
Nobody was aware of Driscoll's other ideas at first.
I mean, Mark Driscoll's whole appeal at the beginning was that he's like not a regular pastor, he's a cool pastor. He would swear and like, you know, wow, isn't this edgy? Having rock shows at the church fit in with that narrative.
Alicia Blake started going to shows at the Paradox when she moved to Seattle from the suburbs. She wasn't religious, but the connection to Mars Hill didn't bother her because the Paradox itself wasn't obviously churchy.
It was a filthy old rundown theater. Some of the seats were left. Some of them were functioning. If it was a room full of kids, it was stinky and sweaty, but just, you know, felt kind of electric.
That electricity was the feeling of all ages community. Tons of bands touring through Seattle played the Paradox. Most were secular, some Christian.
And there's just so many bands that I saw while I was working there. Then I watched them play to 10 people, and it was one of the best shows I think I've ever seen, you know?
Like Jeff, Alicia wanted to be a part of it. She volunteered at shows and then was hired to run audio production.
It was such a like big scene, and it just felt like a lot of things were happening at the time for these bands. The vibe was more just like, we are all here for this one thing, and we're all going to take care of each other. It was like more of a community. And that was something really exciting for me to see.
Everybody would just be up front, jumping off the stage, going crazy. It was safe because everybody's crammed right up there in front of the seats. It was just fun.
As long as church and state stayed separate, so to speak, the Paradox served its intended purpose, a safe place for young people to see live music. But the blending of rock and religion that was happening at the time brought a certain tension. You could hear it in the music itself. Beloved musicians like Damian Jurado and Dave Bazan sang about their moral grappling with church doctrine. And you could see it at the Paradox, because little by little, the boundary broke down, and it wasn't by accident.
The kids that were involved with the Paradox that also attended Mars Hill were pretty tight-lipped about what was happening there, or like what kind of church they were.
I'm a loyal person, and so I got sucked in pretty early on because Driscoll was approachable, and I liked the way that he was hyperbolic at the time, like with some of his ideas. That's obviously a punk rock thing, hyperbole and like a lot of caustic confrontation and whatever else. Early on, they weren't as sort of neo-fascist Christian right kind of things at all.
Driscoll's sermonizing was taking a harsher tone. He was unashamed about inserting himself in people's personal lives. Jeff remembers one night Driscoll called a meeting for young single men where he hammered on the issue of men's rights in traditional gender roles.
He hands us a couple of rocks when we come in. Everybody gets two rocks. They're basically like representation of your balls, right? Later, it's very clear that wasn't so much hyperbolic, and it was very misogynistic.
The way Jeff explains it, this whole bit was Driscoll calling out their weakness for not marrying young and starting families. Real men provide for their women. Wives stay at home and raise the kids. The rocks were his not-so-subtle object lesson. Man up. Word was spreading about Driscoll's bullying tactics and crass sermons. America, he said, was a pussified nation, brimming with femans and male lesbians. He referred to women as penis homes. Their role was to serve their husbands. Gay people were welcome in theory, but they could not become church members. To become a Mars Hill member, would-be worshipers had to verbally agree to the authority of Driscoll and church leadership. In other words, Driscoll expected his congregation to completely submit to his views. He even rewrote the Mars Hill bylaws to further reinforce his own power. Despite the creepy overtones, Mars Hill was becoming immensely popular. Looking back, it's hard to explain. Seattle is historically one of the least religious cities in America, but dressing up conservative Christian values in rock and roll rebellion struck a nerve. It seems like the novelty was enough to draw in curious congregants, and maybe the community they found was enough to keep them coming back. After 4 years headquartered in the University District, 4 years of exponential growth, Mars Hill opened a brand new facility in Ballard. The new space had a full-size concert stage and lighting built in and could hold more than 1,000 worshipers in its main hall. It set Mars Hill back almost $5 million. Driscoll closed the old Paradox and relocated the venue into his gleaming new megachurch.
I probably should have left the church when they shut down that building. I didn't, for mostly my relationships with a bunch of people that I had there.
Alicia wasn't thrilled with the move either. She was now a full-time booker and had a harder time convincing bands that the new venue wasn't a church operation.
And then you're also trying to like tell people attending shows like, no, this isn't the church. I am not with the church. We just happen to have a new place to do these things. Because still at that point, TDO had not been repealed. So like we're still coming up against the same things and still trying to provide that space.
But in fact, church leaders were subtly exerting their influence over the Paradox. Alicia showed up early before each concert to collect the Mars Hill brochures they planted in the dressing room.
There were some pamphlets for man camps and camps for women who are looking to be wives. I'm like, this feels backwards. This does not feel of the 2000s in liberal Seattle. This does not feel good.
Mars Hill was going nationwide. At its height in the mid-2000s, it counted 15,000 members at 15 locations across four U.S. states. 200,000 more watched services online every Sunday.
And I know, unfortunately, there was plenty of people who ended up attending church there because they would see us booking shows, playing in bands, and playing at the church band.
Megan Seeling agreed.
And then it gives validity to whatever it is that church is doing, which it turned out was run by a bigot.
Up to this point, Alicia had been in the dark about Driscoll. Then she tried booking Damian Jurado to play the new Paradox. Damian's agent called her back right away.
And he was like, I don't know if Damian's into playing this show because of where it's at. And do you understand what is happening at this church? And I was like, I don't really know what's happening, but it doesn't feel right. And that was kind of the beginning of the end.
Mars Hill had caught wind of the fact that none of their people were overseeing Paradox events. It was just Alicia. Some church leaders sat her down, told her they were getting more involved, and asked how she felt about it.
And my response was, I have no interest in that. And they asked if I would like to train somebody how to do my job. And I said, absolutely not. I felt like if these guys were going to take over and start getting the church more involved, what I didn't want was all of this time I had spent assuring people that the church wasn't involved to then come to a Paradox show that I wasn't involved in and get a completely different show, to think that it's the same deal and it's not.
Alicia put on the remaining shows she'd booked. After the last one in 2006, a deacon took Alicia's key and escorted her out of the building.
It was not a great way to end things. And I thought for sure they were going to just pick up right where I left off and start doing shows, but they never did anything after that in that room.
Mars Hill stopped putting on concerts, but the church lived on, and so did Driscoll's toxic takes. It wasn't just homophobia and misogyny. He verbally abused coworkers and fired anyone who dared to counter him. The Seattle Times reported that at one meeting, he said, quote, there's a pile of dead bodies behind the Mars Hill bus, and by God's grace, it'll be a mountain by the time we're done. You either get on the bus or you get run over by the bus. In 2012, Driscoll was accused of spending more than $200,000 of church money to buy copies of his own book and juice its ranking on the New York Times bestseller list. It wasn't illegal, but to leaders of the church, it was certainly unethical. In 2014, after years of complaints, Mars Hill's board of advisors conducted an internal investigation. They concluded that Driscoll was guilty of arrogance, responding to conflict with a quick temper and harsh speech, and leading the staff and elders in a domineering manner. 21 former and current pastors at Mars Hill, including Jeff Betker, filed a formal complaint. the church that Driscoll founded kicked him out. Mars Hill dissolved shortly after. Driscoll was basically run out of Seattle, but he found a new flock. In 2016, he started a church in Scottsdale, Arizona. He's still ministering there to this day. Jeff's feelings about his time at Mars Hill are complicated. He says in some ways, it was the best community he's ever been a part of. He stayed with it because of the deep relationships he built with other members of the congregation. He felt like he was making a difference for local bands and music fans. But he also feels some regret, especially when it comes to Driscoll and not recognizing earlier the damage he was doing.
You know, in general, that guy can have the bird all the rest of my life, and I want nothing to do with that stuff anymore. I was definitely always under the impression that we were doing something for the music community of Seattle. My idealism and my youthful vigor for punk rock and all ages shows was definitely exploited. But I wasn't the only one, because so was this whole entire music community.
It wouldn't have happened without the Teen Dance Ordinance. If all ages shows could exist just at clubs and bars, they wouldn't have to have these snakes come in and be like, we have a pretty shiny venue over here for the children.
All ages music is built on strong principles: trust, inclusion, accountability. It's an idealistic version of society, which is what gives it power and meaning. It also makes it vulnerable to people with less idealistic motives. Here's what I find most perplexing. City officials concocted the Teen Dance Ordinance because of alleged bad behavior at a church. The all-night, all-ages disco known as the Monastery was registered as a religious institution. The owner preached sermons to his congregants every night. Yet the authors of the TDO made an exception for religious organizations. And sure enough, they exposed Seattle kids to manipulative adults. It's obvious now and should serve as a lesson for the future. Laws based on fear rather than fact are bound to fail. Despite the demise of the Velvet Elvis and the Paradox, Seattle's all-ages music community was gaining momentum. Finally, they had a plan to eliminate the TDO for good.
Why is it that we allow this law to be in place since 1985? How do you feel about the fact that this law is in existence on the books in the city of Seattle?
Taking the fight straight to City Hall, next time on Let the Kids Dance. Let the Kids Dance is a production of KUOW in Seattle. We're a member of the NPR Network, a coalition of independent, listener-supported media podcasts. If you're enjoying Let the Kids Dance, consider supporting KUOW. Make a donation or become a member at KUOW.org. Let the Kids Dance is created and written by me, Jonathan Zwickel. Matt Martin produced the show. Jim Gates is our editor. Final mixing by Hans Twite. Original music is by Ryan Devlin and Kim West of Smokey Brights and Mega Cat. Our theme song is by The Four Slicks, covering Bo Diddley. CM Ruiz designed our logo. Our production team includes Marshall Eisen, Michaela Giannotti-Boyle, Marian Muhammad, Brendan Sweeney, and Lauren Vespoli. Do you like going to all-ages shows? Did you when you were younger? Did you live through the Teen Dance Ordinance in Seattle? Or were you part of an all-ages scene somewhere else? Tell us about it. Record a voice message on your phone and email it to dance@kuow.org.
At Soundside, we bring you news and conversation rooted in the Pacific Northwest. Hi, I'm Libby Denkman. I think of my job hosting Soundside as, number one, asking tough questions of powerful people, the questions you, KUOW listeners, want answered. And two, bringing you a daily slice of the fascinating, confounding, and often goofy side of life in Washington State. Join me for Soundside at noon and 8 p.m. on KUOW or anytime on the Soundside podcast.